Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Thursday, October 9th. I'm Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUT. In tonight's news, a two-hour standoff involving Eureka PD unfolds at a local motel. California coastal sign rules rekindle debates about billboards at a supervisor's meeting. Prescribed fire underway in Petrolia near Everett's Ridge. These stories and more coming up. At around 11:30 this morning, the Eureka Police Department and Humboldt Bay Fire responded to an incident at the Flamengo Motel opposite the Pearson Building Center on Broadway in Eureka, where early reports indicated that a man had set himself on fire in one of the rooms. These reports were later refuted at the scene by EPD Commander Leonard LaFrance. What unfolded was a standoff, as the man inside the room refused to come out, even after police had fired pepper spray through the rear window of the room. While inside the room, the man, however, did engage verbally with two female officers, apparently from the EPD's mental health unit, who took turns speaking to him through the back window. The officers were heard calling the man by his first name, asking him about his case officer, indicating that the man is local and familiar to law enforcement. Commander LaFrance confirmed this to reporters at the scene, saying the subject was, quote, in crisis, unquote, and having felony warrants. Just before 1:20 p.m., after almost 2 hours, the man was finally apprehended by the Eureka Police Department and taken in for a mental evaluation. This report is partially based on live footage shot by local reporter and KMUD News contributor Ryan Hudson. The videos can be viewed at the website of our news partner, Redheaded Black Belt. State-directed changes to Humboldt County's coastal sign regulations revived a familiar Board of Supervisors debate over billboards. Daniel Mintz reports.
Changes to Humboldt County's sign ordinance, directed by the state's Coastal Commission, reignited a familiar debate among the Board of Supervisors on the balance between the region's scenic beauty and the business value of billboard advertising. Approved in a close vote at the October 7th supervisors' meeting, the changes are to the coastal version of the ordinance and mostly focus on its consistency with the state's Coastal Act. But the board's discussion quickly moved away from the technicalities of the edits to the ideological divide over the importance of billboards. Supervisor Rex Bone voiced the strongest opposition to the spirit of the ordinance, arguing that continuously striking down advertising options is unfair to local businesses.
I understand where this is all coming from and everything else, and it's not that I love billboards. It's just I can't find any of the businesses that advertise on them saying it's the worst thing I've ever done, because some of these billboards have been held by the same companies for 10, 20 years. They've been there 50 years, and we talked earlier about, you know, it'd be nice when our society could pay for all health care, you know, child care and all those things. But it takes private enterprise, private entrepreneurial money to do all that. It's not all going to come from the government. So we keep striking out at small businesses and businesses and, you know, local businesses everywhere we can. And it just gets to be pretty trying on the business community. I've heard from enough of them on this one.
Board Chair Michelle Bushnell would also vote against the changes, saying her decision was a reflection of, quote, difficulties that we are already having with the sign ordinance in her Southern Humboldt district. A key issue is whether there's a divide between the Outdoor Advertising Act, or ODA, and the California Coastal Act. Supervisor Mike Wilson, who is a member of the Coastal Commission, strongly supported the commission's changes, noting the purpose of the ODA.
The ODA was a requirement from the federal government as part of the Federal Highways Act. Federal Highways Act was to, in response to specifically billboards across the United States, the proliferation, and then there was a response that it was to specifically move billboards away from natural areas into commercial areas, if they were to be at all. Many states and even counties within this state have complete bans on and don't have billboards per se in the way that we might think of it. But then the ODA itself was put into existence for this same purpose, which was to remove and move billboards from natural areas and agricultural areas and open space. So I just want to say that's it's not just to regulate them in their existing construct, it's actually to eventually see their removal from those view sheds and those natural areas and those impacts.
Supervisor Natalie Arroyo pointed out that four states, Alaska, Hawaii, Maine, and Vermont, have outright bans on billboards, yet, quote, small businesses and large businesses presumably still flourish there. She argued that billboards are not necessarily a defining factor for success with today's consumers. But Supervisor Steve Madrone suggested there's a middle ground between the seemingly competing interests.
Well, in regards to public access issues, I would note that the Bay Trail, South Bay Trail, that was just completed, veered around an existing sign in order to allow that sign to continue to exist. And it veered up onto the railroad right-of-way. It's the only place on the entire right-of-way from Arcadia to Eureka where the trail actually veers up onto the railroad berm and on the right-of-way there. So I thought that was a great compromise. You know, it was available. Why not veer around it? It works for now. I don't think the train's coming back anytime soon. So it's just an example of where, you know, by inland, or well, by coastal ordinance, if this was in place at that time, the sign would have had to go and get out of the way of the access, right? But I like what they did. You know, they worked with it, and that was a good compromise, I thought, that maintained the sign but also allowed for the trail.
The Coastal Commission's most effectual changes include adding provisions to prohibit signs that interfere with public views or public access inconsistent with the Coastal Act policies, and removing most references to the ODA so the Coastal Act language prevails. The changes were approved in a 3-2 vote, with Bone and Bushnell voting against them. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
Yesterday, on October 8th, the Mattole Restoration Council, with the help of local fire agencies and the Humboldt Prescribed Burn Association, began a prescribed fire near Everett Ridge. Nat Cardos reports.
Yesterday, October 8th, the Mattole Restoration Council, with the help of Petrolia Volunteer Fire Department, Honeydew Volunteer Fire Company, and the Humboldt County Prescribed Burn Association, began a prescribed burn, named the McGinnis Prescribed Burn, near Everett's Ridge in Petrolia. The project is aiming to improve forest resilience to wildfire and promote healthier forest conditions. It is not near any major roadways, though smoke may be visible in the larger Petrolia area, especially in the Conklin Creek neighborhood and Shenanigan Ridge. KMUD News spoke to Ali Friedland, Program Director for the Mattole Restoration Council, for more information on the prescribed burn.
As many of your listening audience know, we are trying to reduce the likelihood of intense wildfires. And so we have projects where we take fuels down in different manners, like thinning the forest. Sometimes we actually remove trees out of ridgeline grassland areas. But we are very specifically on this project going back where we already thinned a forest to put fire on the ground, because it has been too long since there's been fire on the ground there and most places. And it will help both increase the resiliency to wildfire when it comes, but it also helps with the health of the actual forest. We've taken out a lot of the thinner, smaller diameter trees, and so that will help make the forest, the trees that are there, a little healthier. And it will also help in drought conditions, because when there's less water, then there's less for the trees. And so overall, what we try and do at the Mattole Restoration Council is implement projects that somehow restore the health of ecological conditions. conditions. And so the prescribed fire that we are doing over in the McGinnis Creek watershed on Everett's Ridge is part of the multi-phase plan for that area. But when I say Everett's Ridge, we often target ridgelines, and this one is in Humboldt Redwood Company land, and we worked there. However, we don't make a judgment call on who owns what. We target ridgelines that make sense, that in order to do fuel breaks so that when there is a fire, they can be defended, if that makes sense.
The prescribed burn is a broadcast burn, which means it's applied across a large area of land instead of just igniting piles of vegetation. This allows fire personnel to cover more ground section by section to reduce vegetation, invasive plants, as well as mitigate insect populations. Here's Friedland with more about operations.
So we used to do fuels reductions and make piles and go around and start piles on fire. And so that is one kind of prescribed fire, is just doing pile burning. But a broadcast burn is where you're taking swaths of acres and you're actually using a lot of personnel on the ground to put fire across acres. And in this case, we have the units divided into different smaller sections. So depending on how much we want to actually bite off. So if you can imagine, we have these different points along the units as they're kind of shapes on the landscape, where we have holding lines, where we have brought it down to mineral soil so that we can hold a line there and a fire engine could run a hose light, lay down. And so we have different teams, different squads. We have the squad that does the holding, and they just maintain like a line so that we are containing the fire. And then we have squads that are just on the ignitions part, and they take drip torches and they literally go along a line, and they usually start from the top of a unit, or the top meaning in altitude, and then back down, if that makes sense. So they make a line and they go up to a holding line, which is the ridge line, and then they do another line below that, another line of ignitions below that, so that then that burns into that black that they just created. And so the idea is that we are burning down the mountain in little swaths of black so that it's really safe. But it can be quite successful in burning a lot of acres at once. I will say that we have a lot of personnel out there. We have people from the Petrolia Volunteer Fire Department, people from the Honeydew Volunteer Fire Company, Cal Fire is assisting today, and then we have the Humboldt County Prescribed Burn Association that are all helping our Mattole Restoration Council team burn these units.
There is possibility for increased traffic near the area of the McGinnis burn, and the Mattole Restoration Council urges the public not to report this prescribed burn.
I just want to say that for people who are scared of when they hear about the prescribed fire, I want to go back to that idea that it really helps. It helps reduce the impacts of a crazy wildfire. It takes down the risk of having a catastrophic fire by doing these fires in these areas that are where we can defend our ridge lines. And so it's quite a little system of operations where we think about outside of even watersheds, we think of fire sheds and where we can strategically put these fuel breaks and then put fire on the ground where when a fire comes, we can hold back the fire. When a wildfire comes, we can hold back the fire there. And so it's really a good fire in so many ways. It reduces the risk and the threat of catastrophic wildfire. It helps the forest. It gets our firefighters trained. There's so many great effects. It helps with all the diversity of plants that come back. I'm really excited about it, as you can tell. And so, yeah.
The project is sponsored by Cal Fire and Humboldt County Resource Conservation District through the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection's Business and Workforce Development Grants and Forest Health Investment as part of the California Climate Investment Program, which was started in 2013 with the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.
we have three state-level reports coming up from our partners at the Public News Service. The first one being about the bipartisan bill Governor Gavin Newsom signed on Wednesday, yesterday, targeting ultra-processed foods in school lunches. According to the bill, such foods would be phased out over a 10-year period. Suzanne Potter has more.
California has just become the first state to regulate ultra-processed foods in school lunches. Governor Gavin Newsom signed Assembly Bill 1264 on Wednesday. The state health department must adopt regulations defining those foods by June 2028. A year later, public K-12 schools would begin to phase out the most concerning items. According to reporting from KFF Health News, the measure has attracted support from Republicans who have criticized past Democratic efforts to encourage healthier diets. Republican Assemblymember James Gallagher co-sponsored the bill.
Here in California, we grow some of the safest, healthiest food in the world, and yet in our classrooms, often kids are getting junk food. We need to ensure that our kids are eating well. Let's get the chemicals, the additives out of the food.
Some 30 states, many in deeply conservative regions, have passed or are considering restrictions on chemicals in food or food packaging, according to the Environmental Working Group, which co-sponsored the California bill. The term ultra-processed generally refers to food that is industrially manufactured and contains ingredients not typically available in a home kitchen, such as thickeners, gases, emulsifiers, and artificial colors and flavors. Jack Bobo, executive director of the UCLA Rothman Family Institute for Food Studies, supports the law's intention, but worries that the focus on additives is a distraction from the more important task of serving foods low in salt, sugar, and unhealthy fats.
The core challenges are salt, fat, and sugar. So I think that a focus on those would be easier, less bureaucratic, and more likely to be able to deliver short-term gains and improvements in health and nutrition.
Studies show that close to 75% of Americans are overweight or obese, and childhood obesity is rising quickly. This story was produced with original reporting from Claudia Boyd Barrett for KFF Health News. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Somewhat related, we'll have a report from Maine on forever chemicals in food a little later. But for now, we're sticking with youth health in California and Suzanne Potter, who brings us this report on the National Parent and Youth Helpline, which has seen calls double from August to September. At the same time, it is facing major obstacles due to funding cuts at state and federal levels.
Policy decisions on the state and federal levels are creating chaos for the California-based National Parent and Youth Helpline, a service that connects callers in emotional distress to trained counselors. California cut $3 million for the helpline out of the state budget this past June after supporting the program since its inception in 2020. Dr. Lisa Payan Berlin is with Parents Anonymous, the nonprofit organization that runs the helpline.
So we know the demand is increasing, but our capacity is not increasing, which means one thing, our abandonment rate goes up. We can't answer fast enough. We can't respond fast enough because we don't have the staff to do that. People who leave us messages, we call them back. We have people who are in crisis who we call them back several times.
She says the cuts came at a particularly bad time because calls to the helpline doubled between August and September. Payan adds that cuts to SNAP and Medicaid in the Republican tax cut and spending bill passed this summer will hurt struggling families. She adds she worries that the administration will use the government shutdown as an excuse to cut social service programs like the Helpline, which receives $2 million a year in federal funds. In July, the Trump administration pulled the plug on the specialized counseling for LGBTQ people that used to be available on the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Payan Berlin says that, along with other federal policy changes, is causing emotional turmoil.
We get calls from parents concerned about LGBTQ issues of their children and themselves. We get people calling about immigration. We have had parents call us who say, I am going to get deported and my children are U.S. citizens and I'm not sure what to do.
People can call or text the National Parent Youth Helpline at 855-427-2736. Or access live chat online at caparentyouthhelpline.org or nationalparentyouthhelpline.org.
Please note that in addition to the resources named in the report, Humboldt County has a dedicated 24-hour Behavioral Health Crisis Line at 707-445-7715. That's 707-445-7715. The third California-based report on youth and health focuses on new research on how a structured environment can help teenagers become healthy adults.
Research on brain science shows that young people's judgment, impulse control, and planning don't fully develop until about age 24 or 25. Now programs to help adolescents thrive are building on new insights. Studies suggest that young people between the ages of 14 and 24 tend to be more successful if programs are clear and structured around a series of rewards rather than revolving around long lists of rules and punishments. Annie E. Casey Foundation President Lisa Lawson has just written a book on the subject called Thrive.
So there's a huge opportunity for not just education systems, but also employers and nonprofits to learn more about how young people are motivated, what we can reasonably expect of them during this time period, and how to help them be most successful.
Lawson says research and conversations with young people show that teens require five essentials to thrive: basic needs like food, housing, and health care, a caring adult who will stick with them, a good education, career opportunities, and an outlet to show leadership. Alex Medina with the nonprofit Coalition for Responsible Community Development in South Los Angeles says its programs for adolescents use concepts presented in Thrive to address each person's specific challenges.
Every individual who walks through our door has a unique story. They all deserve the same right to thrive in South Los Angeles. So we have tailored programs that can supply housing assistance, bus passes, food support, educational support, whatever they need.
Last year, the coalition served more than 1,600 youths and placed more than 460 in educational or employment programs. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Here at KMUD News, we are working on a report on children, teenagers, and screen time from a local perspective. And we will be bringing you that in due course. But right now, we're going national with a series of short reports that all deal with the environment in one way or another. We have, over the years, brought you several reports on salmon restoration, specifically in the Klamath River and more recently in the Eel River. Over in Wisconsin, they're dealing with a similar issue, not with salmon, of course, but trout, where restoration efforts have led to a significant increase in brook trout population and improved overall habitat health. Judith Ruiz Branch reports.
As dwindling brook trout populations are a concern across Wisconsin, conservation efforts in Iron County are increasing viable habitats for the native species. Fish population spikes are being observed at Kari Creek and the Tyler Forks River after major culvert replacement and restoration projects. A fisheries biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, Zach Lawson, says post-project monitoring shows a 94% increase in juvenile trout at Kari Creek, and fishermen at Tyler Forks report seeing more juvenile trout than they have in a decade.
We see a more even distribution of different size and age classes throughout the stream along the entire reach of Kari Creek, which is fantastic, just what we want to see.
Lawson says brook trout are important as a good indicator of high-quality water resources. Despite the fluctuating weather conditions of climate change, Iron County is predicted to be one area in Wisconsin where brook trout will still be able to thrive. Lawson says that's why projects like these are so crucial. Kari Creek, which serves as a nursery habitat for brook trout, had been diverted from its natural channel into a roadside ditch, causing erosion and flooding issues. Improving it meant replacing 9 culverts and an 800-foot stream restoration that cost more than $400,000 to complete. Heather Palmquist with the Iron County Land and Water Conservation Department says most of the funds came through the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources Trout Stamp Fund.
Our towns, our private landowners, our Wisconsin DNR, just bringing in all sorts of entities and talking with my fisheries biologist about this project, that's how I ended up getting the trout stamp funding. He said, hey, there's a pot of money that maybe we could apply for.
Without grant funds and strong partnerships, she says rural underserved areas like Iron County, with a population of just 6,500, could not undertake these kinds of projects.
They've got small road crews, very small budgets. So a project of this size would not be feasible. These relationships or partnerships up here for us are are so incredibly vital.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
Over in Maine, organizations are backing a federal legislation to better support farmers impacted by contamination from forever chemicals. Catherine Carley reports.
Despite a legal setback, farming advocates in Maine say they'll continue to seek justice for those impacted by PFAS or forever chemicals. Last week, a lawsuit claiming the Environmental Protection Agency failed to regulate the land application of sewage sludge contaminated with PFAS was dismissed by a federal judge. Bill Pluker is with the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association.
We know they're toxic. We know they're being put on the ground. But it's still up to their discretion as to whether or not they're going to do something is not a valid argument. It's not a strong argument.
He says the EPA has known for decades that PFAS are in sewage sludge, which is often used as fertilizer on agricultural fields, although the practice is no longer allowed in Maine. The chemicals have been discovered on more than 90 farms in the state. Maine's congressional delegation has introduced legislation to create a safety net for producers who are struggling with PFAS contamination. The Relief for Farmers Hit with PFAS Act would fund greater soil testing, alternative crop systems, and filters on irrigation systems. Pluker says it would also help ensure farmers stay in business.
When farmers know that they have support in coming forward, they have the courage to come forward.
The fund would also help monitor farmers' health. PFAS persist in the environment without breaking down and are linked to cancer, fertility issues, and developmental delays in children. Pluker praises Maine for leading the nation in PFAS response, but adds a national strategy is needed to ensure the safety of both farmers and our food system. For Maine News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
Our final environmental-related report comes from New Mexico, where satellite data shows that the state's regulatory standards for methane emissions are leading to fewer emissions and also less wasted gas than in neighboring Texas, where the same rules are not in place.
A satellite has documented the positive effects of New Mexico's stricter regulations adopted in 2021. The satellite observed a portion of the Southwest Permian Basin, a major hub for oil and gas operations, and a significant revenue source for both New Mexico and Texas. But Texas doesn't have comparable methane regulations. And Isaac Brown with the Center for Methane Emission Solutions says recent data show Texas's emissions were twice that of New Mexico's.
And that is significant because not only is methane a tremendous contributor to the climate change and a risk to public health, but also it's a huge loss for the economy.
The Environmental Defense Fund estimates that New Mexico's higher rate of methane capture is worth around $125 million annually and would generate about $27 million in royalties and revenue for taxpayers. New Mexico now requires oil and gas operators to capture 98% of produced natural gas, prohibit routine venting and flaring, and implement rigorous leak detection and repair programs. Biden-era upgrades to methane rules would have applied nationwide, but Brown notes they've been put on hold by the current Environmental Protection Agency.
We are certainly hopeful that the Trump administration will reconsider their delay on methane reporting rules and really look at this as a policy issue that can be a true win-win.
In August, a dozen health, environment, and community groups asked the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit to overturn the Trump delay of methane standards for the oil and gas industry. Brown says, unfortunately, additional data from MethaneSat could be limited after it lost contact with Earth in June, the official explanation being a technical failure. I'm Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
That's it for our news today. Nat Cardos will be here at 6 p.m. tomorrow, Friday. All that is left is to thank our engineer for overseeing the broadcast and our reporters who today were Daniel Mintz, Nat Cardos, Suzanne Potter, Judith Ruiz Branch, and Ross Brown. My name is Sigur Bjørn, reporting for KMUD, and I thank you for listening.
KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commute. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmat.org.
Redwood Community Radio is funded by Press Forward, a national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news.